Hello there, and welcome to something very, very special. This is Engineering is Fun, You Should Try It, by Patrick Lettenmeyer, edited by Holly Jones, and narrated by Jack Talbot. As is the case with most Zag stories, the threads of connection weave through generation after generation. Patrick Lettenmeyer graduated with his engineering degree from Gonzaga in 1949, 30 years before Holly Jones was born. Holly began editing his story in 2022, the year she graduated from Gonzaga with her master's degree in communication and leadership, and started the doctoral program in leadership studies. 1 year later, Holly met and hired me, Jack Talbot, and I'm on track to graduate with my bachelor's degree in public relations in May of 2024, 75 years after Patrick Lettenmeyer graduated. You too can leave a legacy at Gonzaga just like Mr. Lettenmeyer. Explore your options at gonzaga.edu/plannedgiving today. Now, please enjoy Engineering is Fun, You Should Try It, by Patrick Lettenmeyer. Introduction by Holly Jones. In January of 2022, Gonzaga University received a gift to support students in the School of Engineering and Applied Science, for which Dean Carlene Hu, Ph.D., wrote an email of thanks to the donation's source, Mr. Patrick Lettenmeyer. Colleagues in University Advancement furnished to Dean Hu Mr. Lettenmeyer's name, graduation year, and field of study. Dear Mr. Lettenmeyer, greetings from the School of Engineering and Applied Science at GU. I am writing to say thank you for your generous support of our General Engineering Scholarship Fund. In case you are wondering, GU's University Advancement Office provided your name and also that you are an ME alum class of 1949. Your continuous support is a clear demonstration of the value you perceive in our students, faculty, and staff. As the current dean since 2019, I can report that I have confidence in our future because of the potential I see realized in this community every day. If you are ever on our Spokane campus, I would be delighted to meet you and give you a tour of our new Integrated Sciences and Engineering building, but also to hear about your career and how GU and SEAS may have contributed to your journey. You are truly a blessing to this community. Again, thank you for your support. Sincerely yours, Carlene. Go Zags! Upon receiving the dean's message of gratitude, Mr. Lettenmeyer responded with an intriguing taste of his story. Dear Dr. Hu, thank you for your kind note about my recent contributions to Gonzaga Engineering School. Many years ago, I lived on a farm in Spokane Valley and had saved $800 that I had earmarked for a mechanical engineering degree from Gonzaga. It was May 1941. I was 17 and lacked 2 high school credits from West Valley High School to graduate. I called Gonzaga and talked to Dr. James McGivern, who called my high school math teacher, Mr. Damon. I never knew what they discussed, but Dr. McGivern agreed to allow me to enroll at Gonzaga if I would somehow gain the 2 missing credits before the end of my first semester. I did earn the 2 credits during the summer of 1941 at Lewis and Clark Summer School and started Gonzaga in the fall of 1941. 1941 was a historic year. December 8, Gonzaga burned down. December 7, Pearl Harbor started World War II, and all my chemistry equipment burned on the third floor. I completed my first year of engineering in May 1942, said goodbye to my $800, and enlisted in the Army. I was broke, which seemed to be my natural condition for the next 5 or 6 years. I returned to Gonzaga the beginning of 1946 and graduated a brand new mechanical engineer in May 1949. Boeing hired me as a junior engineer in May 1949 at $270 a month, and I retired from Boeing in May 1982 as a design engineering manager after a very exciting 33 years of designing spacecraft, airplanes, rapid transit vehicles, and Army combat vehicles. Thank you, Gonzaga, for a great education. Patrick Lettenmeyer. This sampling of Mr. Lettenmeyer's life was enough to whet the appetites of the Gonzaga community to learn more about him and his journey as a resident of Spokane, a World War II veteran, a Gonzaga student, an engineer, and employee of one of the university's top employers. Advancement staff offered to interview Mr. Lettenmeyer and write his story. He did one better, sending it in his own words, piece by piece, over the course of the year. It was an honor and privilege to read and edit, minimally, Mr. Lettenmeyer's life's tale into the pages that follow. His path is indicative of the many benefits that a good education has and exemplifies why supporting it matters. Thank you for your generosity, care, and story, Mr. Lettenmeyer. Holly Jones. Prologue. While I was writing these tales about my engineering career, I often thought I could have surely used the help of my engineering secretary, who could take dictation as fast as I could speak, and never ever allowed me to see a typo. She never flubbed any of my many travel reservations during the 8 years she was my secretary. Her name was Toni Allen. When I hired her, she had been the personal secretary of the CEO of a large Seattle bank. During her interview, I asked her why she was leaving the bank for Boeing Engineering. One word. Money. That's interesting. Don't banks have all the money? 1. The Lettenmeyer Farm was 12 cleared acres of dry farmland at the corner of the Dishman-Mica Highway and Saltese Road in the Spokane Valley, on which a house, barn, and root cellar sat. The pines that once stood proudly there had been clear-cut logged in the late 1800s. At some point, an attempt had been made to irrigate the land to grow alfalfa, but a lack of financing left the land bare and dry. Instead, the upper 10 acres was fenced and used as pasture. I was just 5 years old in the summer of 1928 when my folks decided I was old enough to work for wages on the farm. I put in 6 half-days a week at 5 cents a day and was eager to spend a nickel each week, while the other 25 cents went into a savings account at the Dishman State Bank. My mother stopped at the bank each time she drove the family's 1927 Star Car into Spokane. I had $11 worth of wages in the bank when it busted in 1932. I only got half of it back. "It's a real depression when the banks steal the children's money," Mom said. She established her own bank after that, a tin can at the base of the Virginia creeper vine near the front porch. The entire country became a cash-only economy where money and jobs were scarce. Carpenter jobs paid 50 cents an hour, if you could find one. Luckily for us, we had the family farm. There was a gathering of homeless and out-of-work men growing up along the Dishman-Mica Highway between Sprague and 16th Avenues near Kellogg's Sawmill and the Granite Quarry on the west side of the railroad. We called it the jungle. One day, I followed the trail south from the jungle into the Dishman Hills to hunt ground squirrels and discovered a makeshift distillery. I told Mom about it as soon as I got home. Despite being a strong teetotaler, she said it was best to let sleeping dogs lie. Dad, who we called Hank, was almost as dry as Mom, but had a glass of the home brew each evening. They called it Sour Pop and kept it in the root cellar along with the Swiss lemonade Mom made. I didn't care for either. Not long after I told Mom about the still, there was a knock at our door. It was a couple of suits with a bunch of scrap copper pipes and tubs. The feds had been up the trail in the hills and thought our farm could use the scrap from the still. I sold it for $1. My mother immigrated from Switzerland when she was 12 years old and became a Navy nurse during World War I. My father ran away from school with his brother when he was 10. After being hurt in World War I, he recuperated at the University of Utah, learning the value of an education he never had. I learned very early that Hank, not my mother, was the family disciplinarian. He shaved with a straight razor, sharpened on the strap hung beside the mirror above the kitchen sink. From my earliest years, I'd known the razor strap to have two functions, one of which I seriously avoided. Hank never spanked my sister Marie, and I never understood why. Hank was the best shot I'd ever known. He homesteaded out on the North Fork of the Clearwater River in Idaho for 4 years, but the land never proved up. He bought the undeveloped 80-acre homestead from the United States government in 1916 and moved onto the property that year. The homestead terms were that the homesteader committed to prove up on the land within 3 years by completing several tasks, such as building a house and outbuildings and bringing some acreage under cultivation. Hank built the cabin and some outbuildings during 1916 and late 1917. That year, he was drafted and inducted into a U.S. Army Infantry Division where he broke his back. The war ended November 11, 1918, leaving Hank unable to finish his 3-year homestead requirements. The federal government took back the land title, and Hank was relieved of his commitment. Hank was a tough person. He overcame the broken back, caught tuberculosis, and had a lung removed, smoked, cussed, and worked every day except Sundays. He single-handedly developed the 12-acre farm in Spokane Valley, building the 3,500-square-foot rock home in his spare time. He claimed to have killed 163 deer, 4 bear, and a timber wolf on the old homestead with his rifle, an 1895 lever-action Winchester named Old Betsy. The year I turned 12, Hank let me have my own .22 single-shot bolt-action rifle. My practice target was on a pine tree about 75 yards from our back porch. Hank had hit a 50-cent piece-sized target at 60 feet every time and taught me the rudiments of firing. One early Sunday morning, when I was 13 or 14, he went ground squirrel hunting with me as a favor to our neighbors, who wanted the pests out of their grain fields. We split a box of 50 cartridges and agreed to bring back the tails from our kills. 2 hours later, I was back home with 4 tails and 10 unfired cartridges. Hank was only 10 minutes behind me, carrying 23 tails, having spent all his cartridges. I told you he was a great shot. Hank took old Betsy out to the annual Thanksgiving turkey shoot in Dishman one year and ran into a rather cocky guy who had a newfangled telescope sight on his .30-30, coming home all smiles with 2 shiny $20 gold pieces. That guy couldn't shoot, Hank said of his competitor. On the farm, we had a menagerie of 1,500 chickens, a dozen goats, a steer, several hogs, rabbits, and a flock of turkeys. During the summer, the Kroonquist neighbor's grandson, Dick, from Montana, would stay there with his grandparents. Dick was my age, and frequently he'd come over and spend the day. Funnily enough, the steer we had on the farm was also named Dick. One day, after lunch, Dick and I decided to try to ride Dick the steer. He was nearly impossible to lasso, but we finally roped him and rode until he was tired out. That evening, when my dad came home, he asked me if I'd remembered to water the steer because he looked a bit tired. Some secrets are best left untold. 2. Born at the end of December in 1923, I was too young to start the first grade at the Opportunity Grade School in September of 1929, like the rest of my classmates. Once I turned 6, I was able to join at the half semester in January. Mom insisted that I go to a modern school that had electricity and indoor plumbing. The one-room Chester School had neither. Since our farm was on the south side of Saltese Road and the boundary for the Opportunity Grade School was on the north side, it took pressure from my mother and a friend from the local Grange to get me in at Opportunity. The building was a brick two-story school on the corner of Sprague and Bowdish, with an auditorium and a stage, a woodshop, and a playground with swings. The school bell in the steeple was rung at the start of every day by a large rope hanging inside next to a wide stairway. Next door on Sprague Avenue was the little brick store, which was off-limits during the school day, but once we figured out there was no guard, my weekly 5-cent spending allowance was exchanged there for candy and bubblegum during lunchtime. I got a ride each day of my first semester from Miss Alice Kroonquist, the second grade teacher who lived on her parents' farm about a mile south of ours. At the end of the day, I joined the rest of the kids who walked along the railroad tracks a block south of the school. My first grade teacher was Mrs. Genevieve Feltz. She was the widow of the fallen aviator from whom Feltz Field was named. Mr. Cash was the principal, who ruled from his second floor corner office. Mr. Cash and each of the male teachers wielded a wooden paddle for discipline. I never knew of any girls being hacked, but all the boys were familiar with Mr. Pierce's and Mr. Reps's paddles. Despite that, I liked school. In the fall of my second grade year, my parents bought me a bike to ride to and from school. Only problem was, it was a girl's bike. Mom thought my legs were too short for a boy's bike. I ditched it in the woods every day on my way to school, and the day I forgot it at home, I realized I didn't really need to ride it. Eventually, Hank picked up a used boy's bike for me, and Marie inherited the girl's bike. Mom's ideas about what was good for me extended beyond bikes. She thought I ought to learn a musical instrument and that a Hawaiian guitar was as good as any for me. Once a week, I attended private lessons and was expected to practice an hour a day. My music career lasted for 1 whole year. It ended the day a kid my age named Ronald Davis snatched my guitar from me and jumped on it. Based on my feelings about guitar lessons, it should come as no surprise that my least favorite part of the school year was the once-a-year play performed alongside the school orchestra with parents invited. Participation was required. No exceptions. My second grade appearance in the play commemorating George Washington's birthday was my first, and what I wished to be my last, stage appearance. Clad in knickers and a colonial hat, I was expected to walk on stage carrying a large sketch of the first president and deliver a couple of lines. Instead, I stumbled onto the stage, barely rescuing the sketch of George as I fell. Clutching it in both hands, I launched into my speech as the audience erupted in laughter. As I ran off stage, I could hear someone hollering, "It's upside down!" I was well into high school before I learned to face an audience. 3. I can remember airplanes occasionally flying over the farm during the late 1920s and early 1930s. I met one close up and in person the summer before I turned 6 years old. It was a Sunday afternoon that Hank drove the family in the old Star car out to Liberty Lake for a swim. just off the highway, parked close to the roadside, were two airplanes with a sign that said, "Rides." They were World War I vintage Jenny open cockpit two-seater biplanes with inline liquid-cooled engines, two open seats, windshields, and wooden propellers. After parking the car, Hank and I walked over. "Would you like to take a ride?" asked one of the pilots standing beside the planes in his flying breeches and goggles. "If God wanted me to fly, he'd have given me wings," Hank scoffed. The pilot went on extolling the thrill of flying. I was captivated, but my hopes were quickly rebuffed. I wasn't tall enough to see in the cockpit, but I did get to touch the fuselage and tail section. We stayed and watched the Jennies take several customers up on short flights. It was in those moments that I first fell in love with airplanes. Most Sundays, I attended church school with my grandmother at the Spokane University Christian Church on 8th Avenue and Walnut Street. There, I received a weekly pamphlet full of kids' stories and ads. I enjoyed reading it, especially the advertisements for model airplanes. For 25 cents plus 3 cents postage, you could send away for a kit that would come with a plan, bits of balsa wood, tissue paper, a carved balsa wood propeller, and a long rubber band. When mine came, I put it together, wound the rubber band by the propeller, and launched the craft into the air. I was amazed it actually flew. One of my 5th grade classmates named Keith Hackett brought in a small rubber band model airplane he had made. He'd done nearly the same thing I did, but it was his own design with balsa and glue from a model store in Spokane. His plane flew the entire length of the classroom. About that time, model airplane kits were springing up in the Dishman 5 and 10 cent store. An older kid whose parents ran the gas station on the corner of University and Appleway started a small model material store and stocked up on airplane kits. I was a fantastic customer. Several models hung from the ceiling of my room, some purely for decoration, while others flew very well. The same year I was allowed to have my own rifle, I learned that the young fellow who delivered the Spokesman Review newspaper to the farm belonged to the National Guard Airplane Squadron based at Felts Field. They flew open cockpit biplanes with the newer type radial engines. "Want to come over to Felts Field on Saturday and take a look?" he asked. Saturday couldn't come fast enough. After completing my chores, I pedaled my bike to the guard hangar at Felts, where a huge, single-engine Army observation biplane sat. This time, I sat in the huge airplane's cockpit, moving the main control joystick around. I touched the wooden propeller, but my legs were too short to reach the rudder pedals. The Mamer Schreck hangar was next door with a couple of Piper Club airplanes parked outside. I made a mental note of this for later. There were two monthly magazines available at the Dishman Drugstore: Model Airplane News and Flying Aces. Flying Aces contained model airplane designs and fictional stories. Each issue had a gas engine-powered model designed by Peter Bowers. I reviewed each of the drawings with great interest. An advertisement for the Curtis Wright Technical Institute of Glendale, California, caught my eye. I'd heard of Washington State College, now Washington State University, the University of Washington, Gonzaga University, and Whitman College, where my Aunt Ellen had taught. I was sure University of Washington was the only school that taught airplane engineering. I told my mom about my ambitions to go to the Wright Institute, and she replied, "Pay attention to your chores, do a good job on your newspaper route, learn to play the Hawaiian guitar, and keep your grades up." In other words, my Curtis Wright Technical Institute aspirations crashed before they ever flew. At least I had my models, and Ronald Davis had thankfully destroyed my guitar. 4. Hope, like money and jobs, was scarce in 1935 America. The Depression had spread worldwide, with inflation particularly soaring in Germany. Our president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, had grown his political wings, serving in several governmental positions during World War I. I remember the great speech in which he declared, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." The flood of government programs that followed did little to help Spokane, where the economy was dying. There was no market, so the apple orchards of the valley were being pulled up, and the Opportunity apple packing plant closed. The national motto seemed to be, "Brother, have you got a dime?" If you had half of one, you could afford a hot lunch at my school. If you didn't have the 5 cents, the teacher would stake you. I carried my lunch from home in a tin lunchbox with a thermos bottle every day. While so much around us was crumbling, our farm was still doing well. Mom ran the place and sold eggs for 15 cents a dozen. Our sign on Dishman Micah Road in the springtime read, "Fries dressed, 3 for $1. It was rare for us to keep any cockerels. The pullets were prized livestock. After 5 years of construction, we moved into our new house in the mid-1930s. We now had electricity, running water, a bathroom, and Saturday night baths. Meanwhile, in Europe, things were about to explode. Hitler had taken over Germany, and the entire Russian royalty had been eliminated. Non-communists were being chased into eastern Russia, and there were faint signs that the French and British would soon awaken to Hitler's threat. By 1935, Roosevelt's program started to take hold. There was little money around, but the soup lines had gotten shorter. Many guys my age were joining the Civilian Conservation Corps for $50 a month, with a uniform and camp to stay in while working in the western forests, eliminating blister rust disease. I already had 3 square meals a day, clean sheets, and a prospering paper route, so I passed on the opportunity to join up. At 16, I switched paper routes from carrying the Evening Chronicle to the Morning Spokesman Review. I kept that up until I left West Valley High School in 1941. My grades paid the price of the 4 a.m. wake-up my route required, but the extra money I saved helped make up for it. My folks were determined to have me run the family farm after graduating, but I wasn't hot on the idea. Curtis Wright was still on my mind, and I was pinching pennies to make it happen. Not long after changing my paper route, I got my driver's license. 2 months later, I wrecked Hank's brand new 1936 Dodge sedan, decreasing my college savings by $115. Whoops.